Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Whose responsibility is it to keep the internet open and accessible to everyone? Earlier this month, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia struck down a set of rules that had been established by the Federal Communications Commission in 2010. These rules, known as the Open Internet Order, had been established by the FCC to ensure a level and fair playing field for the web, meaning that internet service providers were not allowed to block or prioritize any traffic. It's what most people are talking about when they use the term net neutrality. But the recent court decision to overturn the FCC rules could be seen as a hefty blow to net neutrality. As one of today's guests, LA Times business columnist Michael Hiltzik, says, the decision thoroughly eviscerated the Federal Communication Commission's latest lame attempt to provide prevent internet service providers from playing favorites among websites. A recent report about net neutrality from CalPERG highlights the potential repercussions. It writes, when internet service providers provide preferential treatment to their own services while blocking or slowing down competing services, innovative new businesses are blocked from entering new markets and consumer choice is curtailed. The absence of net neutrality rules could create a pay-to-play culture where only those businesses that are able and willing to pay ISPs can reach users and markets. So what do you think about net neutrality? Who should be regulating the internet, if anyone, and how? Can consumer pressure solve the issue, and what's at stake for creators and consumers alike on the World Wide Web? To talk about all of this and help us sort it out, we're joined by John Bergermeier. He's a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge. He advocates for the public interest before courts and policymakers, and he works to make sure that all stakeholders, including ordinary citizens, artists, and technological innovators, have a say in shaping emerging digital policies. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Josh Levy, who's the Internet Campaign Director with Free Press. He leads the organization's work to protect internet freedom, stop government and corporate surveillance, secure public use of the public airwaves, and provide universal access to high-speed internet. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how's it going?
And Michael Hiltzik is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist of the LA Times. He's the author of five books, most recently The New Deal, A Modern History, and he's been covering the latest news around net neutrality. Hi, Michael.
Hi, it's good to be here with you.
Thank you. So we're going to go deeper into kind of the pros and cons of the court decision and hear more about that. But just kind of a lightning round, can I get each of you to give us your sort of headline about the recent court decision? I've heard everything from the sky is falling to who cares. So in a few sentences, what does this decision portend? Let's start with you, Michael.
Well, I don't think I've heard anybody say who cares, because this is going to affect, for good or ill, every stakeholder in the internet, everybody who goes online or sells anything online. Basically, the court ruling said that the FCC's way of regulating net neutrality or regulating this sort of traffic on the web didn't pass legal muster, and it threw it back at the FCC or Congress to find a better way to do it if they so choose.
And how about you, Josh? What's your read on this decision?
This is pretty much the end of the internet as we know it, until we can get the FCC to go back and pass strong net neutrality rules that will actually hold up in court. So until they do that, ISPs like Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, Time Warner Cable, and others are free to do a whole host of bad things to us. They can block websites, they can block applications, they can block any services that we're using to connect to the internet, and there's nothing to stop them. It's perfectly legal for them to do that. So if that's the status quo at the moment, then the internet that we've grown to love and that's been such a driving engine for innovation and education and social change is pretty much gone until we can get those net neutrality rules back.
And how about you, John? What's your take?
Yeah, I'd second all of that, but I'd point out that the decision does trace out a very clear path for the FCC to bring its rules back if it chooses to. So it's really in the FCC's court right now. And not only that, the decision also, it pointed out that the FCC actually provided very good evidence that net neutrality rules were needed. And it also pointed out that the FCC probably does have statutory authority to pass net neutrality rules. It just did the wrong thing. You know, it used the wrong legal tools. So given that the court already accepted that the FCC essentially made the policy case for net neutrality, you know, it's really up to the FCC to make sure, you know, that it enacts that really smart policy choice of net neutrality rules.
And to let everybody know, we did invite the FCC and they did not respond. Can you go into that just a little bit more, John? What do you mean that they had the wrong rules? Explain this court decision a little bit more for us.
Yeah, sure. The FCC categorizes different communication services in a variety of ways. Two of those categories, one is called information services, and that's like, you know, we generally think of it as something that hooks up to a network. So on the Internet, something like Amazon.com or Twitter, those are information services. That's what you use the Internet for, you know, to access information and to interact with stuff. And then on the other hand, you have something which would just be a telecommunication service, and that is, you know, a phone line that just connects you from A to B, or in my view, broadband Internet access is a telecommunication service. It's just providing you the information to connect up with another service or another person. So, you know, that's the main distinction. It's like, are you a user of the network, or are you, you know, the network itself? The FCC, for a lot of reasons, mostly because, you know, a lot of deregulatory push that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s, they decided, well, we don't want to treat the Internet like a telecommunication service. We want to treat it, you know, like the telephone system. We want to treat it more like an information service. So they did that, and it was deregulated. But then when the FCC decided, oh, wait, we actually do need some protections for Internet users, it passed those rules. And what the court said was, hey, FCC, you can't basically have your cake and eat it, too. A lot of these protections that you're trying to enact through your net neutrality rules, those are the kinds of things that you can do to telecommunication services, but not information services. So we're striking down your rules. If you want to go ahead and reclassify broadband access as a telecommunication service, you know, that's open to you. But until you do that, your rules are not valid.
And, Michael, so I said that I'd read everything from Who Cares. So Larry Downs of Forbes wrote, doomsday scenarios aside, the reality is that consumers have nothing to fear from this decision. There was never a case for regulating, which is why the Open Internet Order referred to its rules as prophylactic a dozen times. The providers, in any case, have a long since pledged to abide by the principles of the Open Internet, et cetera, et cetera. Can you just respond to that, maybe?
Sort of thing from...
Can you start again, Michael? I'm so sorry. We had a bad line there.
I'm sorry. You're going to hear that sort of thing from pundits and lawyers who... what's left out here is that most people, most customers of the Internet, most of us in our homes, we really don't have a choice. And that is a very important element of this. Essentially... at your home, you've got a choice of one cable operator, and that cable operator provides the best access for you. You may have a telecommunications, a telephone company that has inadequate DSL, much slower. Very few homes have access to fiber services like Fios or UVerse. So basically, what's left out here is that it really is left up to the ISPs to decide who they are going to favor and who they are not going to favor. And that's very important.
And is there any evidence that this favoritism is happening at all?
Well, there certainly is. In fact, there's been a case involving Comcast, which is the largest cable operator, the largest cable ISP that we've got, was caught disadvantaging streams from BitTorrent, which had obviously offers video transmission services over the Internet. It was degrading those streams, allegedly to favor its own video service. The FCC caught it, disciplined it, forced Comcast to essentially to pledge not to do that again. But that's a clear case of what's happening. And, of course, since then, Comcast has acquired NBC Universal, which gives it even more incentive to favor its own content, its own bitstream over competitors.
And what do you think is the significance of the plaintiff in this case? It was Verizon that was challenging the FCC's open Internet order. What does that say about who does and doesn't want net neutrality?
Well, Verizon essentially is the equivalent in terms of mobile Internet and fiber Internet to Comcast. It's a big player. It's a big ISP. In fact, Comcast Verizon brought this lawsuit, an earlier lawsuit that invalidated earlier rules that the FCC was trying to implement, came from Comcast. So essentially Verizon and Comcast, I think, functionally are indistinguishable as attackers of net neutrality.
And Josh, you said that there's a clear path for the FCC to reclassify broadband as telecommunications. How realistic is that? What are the pros and cons of doing that?
How realistic is a good question, because it's a political decision. The ability for the FCC to make the decision to reclassify broadband as a communication service, as John was describing, it can do that essentially today. It can just make a decision that it's going to do it and then pass new rules that would be written in such a way that would hold up to legal scrutiny because they've reclassified in the right way. Now, how politically willing are they to do it? I think that's up in the air right now. The chairman, Tom Wheeler, has said that all options are on the table. And so from our perspective, the really important thing to do is to tell the FCC that you think net neutrality matters and that the only way to actually get it is for that agency to reclassify. Otherwise, its rules will never hold up in court. And so, I wanted to just refer to a question that you asked. Who is against net neutrality and who would be for it? The only people out there that are against net neutrality, which is like being against free speech, are the ISPs, because they have a lot to gain in the form of profit from suppressing our ability to connect and communicate online. Anyone else who uses the Internet wants to be able to access what they want without any corporation or government agency getting in the way. And so that's why we think these basic common sense rules that would enable net neutrality for everybody need to be passed. But the only way to do it is to get the FCC to reclassify. And the only way to get them to do that is to have an intense amount of public pressure applied to that agency so that they are willing to do the right thing with the appropriate political cover.
Well, let me just push you a little bit on that and play devil's advocate. And I'll quote Larry Downes again of Forbes. He says, the market is turning in the direction of consumers and large content providers who each have increasing leverage to police broadband providers. I think that the argument is that consumers would rebel against censorship of their access.
So consumers definitely would if they had a choice, if there was actual competition. The problem of net neutrality exists because there is no competition in the broadband market. The vast majority of Americans have a choice of one broadband provider, maybe two if they're lucky. For example, where I live, I have a Comcast connection. If Comcast decides to use what's legally available to it and then start blocking my access to certain applications or services, I have nowhere else to go. And the vast majority of Americans are in exactly the same position. So in the absence of competition like that, we need rules that just lay the groundwork for a basic open Internet.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking about net neutrality and an open Internet. Whose responsibility is it to keep the Internet open, and what does it mean for you? A federal appeals court recently overturned FCC rules that prohibited Internet providers from giving preference to applications and content. So theoretically, your Internet provider could block or slow down what you have access to, ending what we call the open Internet era. Some, like our guests, are calling for the web to be regulated like other telecommunications companies. And let me invite you to join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you think that the decision was appropriate, please join our conversation and speak with our guests. I'll reintroduce them in just a second. How do you think the Internet should be regulated? Does it make sense that sites or consumers of sites should pay more to the Internet service provider for better connection? And if you've been following the net neutrality battle, what do you think of the latest court ruling to overturn the open Internet order? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we're joined by John Bergmeier, who is a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge, Josh Levy, who's the Internet Campaign Director with Free Press, and Michael Hiltzik, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist of the L.A. Times. We also invited the FCC but didn't hear back from them. I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit more about the composition of the FCC and what that might mean for regulation for the debates going forward. Go ahead, John.
Sure. Well, the FCC is a five-member commission. It's an independent agency, which means that the president doesn't directly control what they do. So it's unlike an agency like the Environmental Protection Agency, where, you know, there's just one head of that agency who's appointed by the president and basically serves at the president's pleasure. So it's an independent agency, and there's five votes, and there are three members of the president's party, so there are currently three Democratic members and then two Republican members. But really, the agenda on this, I think, is going to be driven by the chairman, because I think whatever the chairman decides, and it, particularly if he decides to protect the open Internet, it seems likely at this time that he'd be able to get at least the two other Democratic commissioners to vote with him. Now, Tom Wheeler's background is that he is has experience. He's worked for the wireless industry. He's worked for the cable industry. So some people have pointed out that his industry ties might make him unwilling to go and actually classify broadband access as a telecommunications service. But on the other hand, he has shown himself to be independent-minded and pro-consumer in a number of respects, so that's why it's up in the air. It's really a matter of what the chairman decides, I think, at this point.
And do either of you, Michael or Josh, want to weigh in on that, the composition of the FCC, the money involved here?
Well, this is Michael, and I'll just say that over the last 10 or 20 years, we've seen a certain amount of regulatory capture at the FCC, and that is that some of the industries that it's supposed to regulate basically have been getting their way. Of course, Tom Wheeler is very new at the agency. But the root of this problem with net neutrality and the way the FCC has regulated it really dates back many years to an FCC that was under Michael Powell. He was chairman. He basically cooked up this idea of classifying ISPs as information services rather than telecommunications services. That was in 2002, and I would point out that Michael Powell, who was then chairman of the FCC, is now the chief lobbyist in Washington for the cable TV industry. So I think we have reason to be a little bit concerned about these issues being in the hands of an agency like this. The real problem is that restoring net neutrality or making sure that it's adequately and aggressively enforced requires affirmative actions, really proactive actions by the FCC and by Congress. And those sorts of things are very hard to come by in Washington today.
And can you talked about the sort of roots of the problem. Can one of you, maybe Josh or John, explain kind of how the Internet evolved to be what it is today?
Sure. Remember when commercial Internet access first became very popular, it depended on a telecommunications network, that is, the phone network, because the majority of people, home users in particular, dialed into ISPs, and you had a choice of ISPs. So if one ISP wasn't doing a good job, you could switch to another one, and it was relatively easy. Because the telephone network was a non-discriminatory telecommunications network, the phone companies had no choice but to connect you to the ISP of your choice. And in fact, they went to the FCC to change that, and they lost because they wanted ISPs that connected to their phone network to be treated like long distance carriers and have to pay significantly more. But that didn't happen, and that was great. But then what happened? Then as technology evolves, and technological progress is a good thing. When broadband rolled around, instead of having a non-discriminatory communications network that you could just connect to an ISP of your choice, you just had the person who owned the wire that ran into your house was also your ISP for the most part. So we ended up losing the competitive choice of ISP that we used to have. And so because there's no competition in ISP, and because basically the person who owns the wire is also your ISP at the same time, people have essentially lost their choice. So this is why we're saying that, if there's a wire coming into your house and there's a single company that controls it and you don't really have a competitive choice, just like with wireline telephone, you need to regulate that service to make sure it ends up protecting consumers, because competition isn't going to be enough because it's not there.
And what would it mean for the Internet to be regulated just like other telecommunications like TV, radio, and telephone? How would that work?
Well, I mean, we're not saying that the Internet should be regulated. I mean, this is sort of a terminological point, but I think it's an important one, that we're not saying that websites should be regulated or email should be regulated or any of the services that use the Internet. Really, it's just the telecommunications service that has, you know, in most markets, like Josh was saying before, they don't face any competition. It's essentially a natural monopoly, just like your water company or the power company. So they should be regulated so that they operate in a non-discriminatory manner. So it's really just about making sure that the access to the Internet remains non-discriminatory, so you don't have this single gatekeeper that's able to exert control over on the rest of the Internet.
And why do we...
If I could just butt in a little bit, I obviously agree with everything that's been said. I just want to reiterate this one point about terminology. You'll hear a lot of opponents of net neutrality say, well, these people want to regulate the Internet that you use, and that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important to, A, note that in all common terminology, we tend to conflate the Internet with the web, with broadband, et cetera, and that's just part of the language that we use every day. So it's important to distinguish, first of all, the Internet from the web, which is, the web is something that rides over our Internet connections, and also when we say things like, we want the FCC to regulate the Internet, as John was just saying, we just want rules that protect our Internet connections, the things that connect us to the Internet. And
the ISPs, the Internet Service Providers.
That's right, just the service providers. We just want a guarantee of access. That's the only thing we're asking for. So I would just encourage our listeners to beware when they hear opponents of net neutrality conflating things like the Internet and the web and Internet service providers.
Well, I might have done that a little just to avoid redundancy in my introduction, so apologies here. Mary from San Francisco writes, why do we hear that Europeans have better service for less cost? What are other countries doing, I think, is a logical question out of that.
Well, I mean, I'd like to point out there's in some countries have adopted an approach where instead of just net neutrality, you have what's called open access, where the wire provider to your house is regulated in a way that's actually more similar to the way the phone network used to be, where you can have different competitive ISPs that sort of are able to share the same infrastructure. So in a lot of European and Asian countries, you have more competition, which tends to drive down price. And the reason you have that competition is because they have these open access policies that sort of, it's a regulation, but it's a regulation that in turn creates competition.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about net neutrality, the open Internet era, and the recent federal appeals court ruling that overturned FCC rules that prohibited Internet providers from giving preference to applications and content. We're speaking with John Bergmeier, who's a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge. He advocates for the public interest before courts and policymakers. We're also joined by Josh Levy, who's the Internet Campaign Director with Free Press. He leads the organization's work to protect Internet freedom, stop government and corporate surveillance, and secure public use of the public airwaves. Michael Hiltzik is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist of the LA Times. He's the author of 5 books, most recently The New Deal, A Modern History, and he's been covering the latest news around net neutrality. We also invited the FCC to join this conversation, but we didn't get a response. And we want to invite you to join our conversation. How do you think the Internet should be regulated, or what rules apply to protect consumers and an open access to the Internet? And if you think that the decision was appropriate by the Federal Appeals Court, join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. Talk. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can post comments at yourcallradio.org. And we will be right back after a short break. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call.
In case you missed it, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. You can also send an email question or comment, if you like, to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Today, more discussion of last night's State of the Union Address. That's coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC, here on Local Public Radio. It's 10:30.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, how far have we come with HIV and AIDS activism? We'll have a conversation with Sean Strub, who's the author of Body Count, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. What can we learn from the first wave of HIV/AIDS activism in the U.S.? Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We'll be speaking with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today, should the Internet be regulated like radio and TV and other telecommunications? A federal appeals court recently overturned the FCC's rules that prohibited Internet providers from giving preference to certain applications and content. Some critics say this will eliminate fair Internet access and end the Internet as we know it. So whose responsibility is it to keep the Internet open? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, or feedback at yourcallradio.org. Our guests, let me just remind everybody that we're speaking with John Bergmeier, who's the senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge, Josh Levy, who's the Internet campaign director with Free Press, and Michael Hiltzik, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist of the LA Times. And we're going to go to calls in just a second, but I'm wondering what should consumers know about sort of the best and worst case implications of this court decision? Why don't we start with you, Michael?
Well, sure. The worst case is that consumers will find that some of their favorite services are degraded because their ISPs have either a favored rival service or is offering it itself. For example, you might find that your Netflix movies don't look as good on your TV as they used to, and in some cases we find that that may already be happening because your ISP, maybe it's Comcast, wants to sell you its video stream with NBC and Universal Movies. So I think that's certainly the worst case, or in some cases you might find that you don't have access at all to a service or a website because your ISP has decided that either has found that service or website isn't willing to pay an additional fee that the ISP wants to charge, or is carrying content that the ISP doesn't like for one reason or another. With the state of play right now as a result of this court ruling, we've heard certainly some experts say that an ISP can block or degrade access to certain websites or services for any reason it chooses or for no reason at all.
And, John, do you want to talk a little bit about the sort of best and worst case scenarios? And I wonder if there's a positive side to this ruling as well.
Well, the worst case scenario is pretty easy to imagine. You know, it just involves wholesale blocking of services that an ISP chooses not to let travel to reach consumers. I think the most likely scenario is that ISPs take it bit by bit and they do it slowly. I mean, we already see AT&T Wireless has a sponsored data plan where a content provider can pay to exempt its own advertisements or its own service from data caps, which sort of encourages consumers to, you know, use the services that are exempted from data caps, and it gives the people who can afford to pay and deal with AT&T an advantage over the other ones. And Comcast, in fact, is doing a similar thing with its with a video service that's available through an app on the Xbox. It's exempting its own video from caps, while, you know, Netflix and Hulu aren't exempted from caps. So, you know, the way that I see it is that the ISPs, you know, they just keep testing the waters, and they, you know, they do things bit by bit. You know, first it's exempting from data caps, then it's priority for services that they want to give an extra boost to, and it just sort of builds up like that. You know, and, you know, a couple years down the line, you know, the open Internet that we know and love, you know, is gone, and it's happened relatively slowly.
Right, and if I can interrupt here, I would add that that Tom Wheeler, the new chairman of the FCC, has made some statements suggesting that he's okay with some of these innovations, such as AT&T's sponsored sponsored Bitstream, he's okay with them trying it in advance, and he says we'll take a look at it once it's implemented and decide whether it actually does violate rules that we want to preserve. So this is one reason why I think many in the open internet community are a little bit skeptical or suspicious of where Tom Wheeler is going to bring the FCC.
And let's go to some of our callers. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about net neutrality and a recent court decision that one of our guests says is going to end the Internet as we know it, or has that potential, unless the FCC regulates or puts some rules in place to protect consumers and creators. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to Your Call.
Well, thank you very much. I just listened to your guests' remarks as to what scenarios one might anticipate, and I think that addresses the question we were going to ask, which is, how would you know it? How would you feel it? What would your perception be if this unregulated worst-case scenario became a day-to-day actuality? And how would you realize all of a sudden that there was a lot of mush in your communications? Would it seem as if people who were calling you through the phone on the Internet were talking with their mouth full, or would it seem as if some of the crisper images were coming on a extra, you had to pay extra for them?
Well, stay on the line, George. Yeah, so what are we going to actually experience as consumers?
Well, I think George is absolutely right, and as I said a little bit earlier, some ISP customers in some places have already reported, or at least indicated that they're seeing this. Your Netflix movie, which was crystal and clear a week ago, suddenly it comes over, it's pixelated, it's muddy, maybe it stops and restarts more frequently than you thought. You might find that certain other websites take a much longer time to load, but favored websites come over just great. So that's what you would begin to see.
How is that different than, say, what a Google search already does?
So this is Josh. So,
yeah, so thanks, Josh.
We like to use the metaphor of the proverbial frog that's thrown into hot water, doesn't know it's being boiled alive, right? That's the Internet user. So we might not notice anything right away, but slowly, let's say in a year from now, you'll realize that you've been seeing that buffering sign, that dreaded buffering sign, more and more when you're trying to watch online video. And I would counsel, we've talked a lot about Netflix on this show and elsewhere. You're hearing a lot about Netflix regarding net neutrality. There's also a lot of competitors out there. There are competitors that exist now that are trying to offer different kinds of services than Netflix does, and also those in the future, that are going to try to compete with this huge empire that Netflix is building. All of those folks will suffer, and the consumers who are trying to access those services will suffer. Those videos will start loading more slowly. Applications that you want to use that you can use to connect to the Internet might not work in the way that you want them to. Here's an example. Last year, AT&T, when Apple introduced the new iPhone, the iPhone 5, it was actually, which is old now, quote-unquote, it introduced FaceTime calling over the mobile Internet, and AT&T went out and blocked it unless you would, quote-unquote, upgrade to a more expensive plan that actually had more voice minutes, which you didn't need if you were using FaceTime, which is a video calling app. It blocked access to that because it didn't want it to compete with its own services, and we actually called them out for that. It was actually a blatant violation of existing FCC rules, the ones that were just thrown out a couple of weeks ago. You're going to see stuff like that all the time. Any new kind of mobile application that introduces a new way for us to connect on the Internet, the carriers are free to block it. Anything that you use on your desktop or your laptop to do the same, they're free to block it. Let's say you're concerned about privacy and you want to use encryption tools in order to keep your communications private. Verizon or Comcast or anyone else could say, we don't allow encryption technology to flow over our networks. We're going to block that unless you open it up for us to look at. Or they could say, you have to give us your encryption key, which is the thing that allows them to read your communications before transmitting that communication. There are all kinds of things that could happen. They may not happen tomorrow, but they'll start happening more and more. And then one day you'll wake up and realize that the Internet that you were used to, that you had expected to exist, is gone. It's not there anymore. One other thing I'll just add is that you'll also see, and I think, George, I think you mentioned this, that you'll see a cableization of the Internet. Suddenly, you'll be asked to pay extra for websites that you used to access for free. So instead of paying a flat rate for your cable connection, your cable broadband connection, maybe you have to pay $5 a month extra for Facebook and YouTube, or $10 a month extra for Netflix and things like that.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about the concept of an open Internet where public networks treat all content equally, and a recent court case that overturned FCC's rules on that. We're speaking with John Bergmeier, who's a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge, Josh Levy, who's the Internet Campaign Director with Free Press, and Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist with the LA Times. We'll put links to all of their articles and information at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to, let me give out the phone number if you want to join our conversation and ask questions about what this means for you and what you as a consumer might want to do. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And let's go to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to your call.
Yeah, good morning. Just to give you an example of a specific thing that I have in San Francisco with real numbers, I have a landline and DSL service, DSL for my Internet that runs over the copper phone lines. And for years and years, like a decade, I had paid about $25 a month for 3 megabits down, which is fine for me. And it renewed every year. It was the same price. And you could even get it cheaper for about $20 in some areas. So that went on for a decade. Well, recently, just this in the last year, I didn't notice it, but the AT&T hiked up the cost that was the same for all that time to $41. And when I called to ask about it, they wanted to switch me to UVerse, their all-in-one package, which is basically...
So, Ken, let's
anyway,
get a response.
So my point is that the Verizon CEO has said that he wants to kill the copper, and the victims of the Sandy storm found out in the East Coast that their new service, which was Verizon's Fios or something that delivered it to a node in the neighborhood and ran over telephone lines, he said they want to kill the copper. So there's another competing pressure. It seems like the FCC or the Supreme Court wants to deregulate, and that gives the companies the way to knock out the old phone system, which is really what emergency communications depends on. In a country that constantly talks about a war on terror, that's about the last thing you want to do.
And let's get a response. John, why don't you respond to Ken, this idea of emergency telecommunications and...
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the problems that Ken is pointing out are exactly traceable to the fact that you don't have competition for these communication services or for Internet access, or what competition you have is extremely limited. You know, and this is why you need consumer protections. And you know what? Net neutrality is not the only protection that consumers need. You know, net neutrality wouldn't necessarily protect consumers against broadband that's cost too much or is unaffordable or is not fast enough. And we're, you know, I support net neutrality, but it's not the only thing I support. And I think that the root cause of net neutrality is just the nature of communications and how it isn't particularly competitive. You know, and I think Ken's problem with AT&T, traces to that same underlying issue.
And we got an email from Judith. I believe that it's important to maintain net neutrality. I'm currently on the FCC comment page. We'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. And Judith says, thanks to your guests for their work to preserve Internet freedom, and asks, what's the key thing we need to call on the FCC to do? Josh.
What exactly are we calling on the FCC to do?
Yeah, like consumers, people who are listening right now, and she's on the comment page. She's saying, what are we calling on them to do?
We're calling on, it's a simple thing. It should be simpler. I understand it's a bit bureaucratic, but we're calling on the FCC, John did a good job describing this earlier, to reclassify broadband as a telecommunications service. So that's what the FCC needs to hear us say to them. Actually, we have a petition for this at savetheinternet.com. You can go there, and you can add your name to our petition. We have 130,000 people that have signed it already, and learn a lot more about this reclassification thing there. But what we're asking them to do is to move broadband from the information services category to the communication services category. And what that will do, will it will give the FCC the proper authority, as was granted to it in the Communications Act back in the 1930s, to protect Internet users from Internet service providers and stop them from blocking access to information, to websites, to applications, et cetera. And so what they need to hear from you is that they need to reclassify broadband as a communication service.
And let's go to Andreas from San Francisco. Hi, Andreas.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask the panel of experts that are you aware that when you reclassify Internet services to telecommunications, that there is a tax of 16.5%, which is going to be assessed on every consumer's phone bill? That's $16 on $100. It's called the Universal Service Fee Tax.
So he's talking about the tax on telecommunications and how would this affect Internet ISP providers?
Yeah, I mean, just to address that really quickly, there are a number of regulations that could apply to telecommunications services, whether it's telephone, whether it's Internet access, whether it's anything else, if the FCC chooses to allow them to apply. So, you know, that's a separate policy question of, you know, how do we, you know, one day extend the universal service policies that make sure that currently make sure that telephone service is available to everyone? How do we extend that to broadband? But I think that's a totally separate question, you know, than the issue of net neutrality. And it's not automatic that all things such as, you know, a universal service surcharge would apply to Internet access. You know, that would just be one of the many policy choices that the FCC would have to make.
And how does this decision affect the digital divide? Go ahead, Josh.
So I would say that access to the Internet is only as valuable as what you can actually access on it. So it's incredibly important to build out basic communications infrastructure and access in communities that either don't have any access to the high-speed Internet at all, or for whom access is too expensive and out of reach, or for whom it's improperly built out. It's incredibly important that we build out those connections. Interestingly enough, reclassifying broadband as a communication service will help the FCC pass policies to make that happen and to implement, not only to bridge the digital divide, but also to help implement more competition by having more access providers in local regions. But in addition to that, it's incredibly important that when we have access to the Internet, that Internet is open. If, for example, Comcast builds out access to an underserved community, that's a good thing. But if it's only providing the applications and websites that it approves, then it's not really the full Internet that community is getting, and that community is not able to properly engage with the Internet the way that most of the rest of the world is. And so that's increasingly the case, and we're seeing that low-income consumers are actually being given options like mobile phones that access Facebook for free without a count against data plans. That's creating a two-sided Internet. You know, one Internet is the one that the developed world and upper-income people can afford to have. And the other one is this kind of like half Internet, which is hobbled by Internet service providers, where people can only get what is approved by those providers. And so we don't see that as an appropriate solution.
And Nick writes in, since it runs so contrary to the American way of running the Internet, please say more about how open access came to be in Europe, Japan, and Korea, and how that stability is maintained. We touched on this right before the break, how other countries are responding to this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, Michael?
Well, I think what's happened is it's really what did not happen in some other countries. They didn't layer this sort of commercial free enterprise, the market beats everything concept on top of their access to the Internet. This is unusual. The United States is unusual in really turning over the last mile to cable companies and telecommunications.
As opposed to the government owning it?
Well, it's not a question of the government owning it. It's really a question of these players, the cable operators and the telecommunications companies, having a monopoly to your home. That is really the problem. There's much more competition, and there's an understanding in most other countries that you really need to give everybody the same shot at reaching the customer. We simply don't have it here. Here we we turn over the last mile to commercial players on a monopoly or a monopolistic basis, and then we don't really monitor what they are doing, or we certainly don't enforce the principles that we should be.
And let's,
Josh, if I could just
go ahead, Josh.
Well, you know, this points to what I was just saying before, which is that net neutrality and open access is totally connected to broadband build-out. And so in those countries that you named, places like Japan or South Korea or the Netherlands or elsewhere, you have broadband services that are overseen by regulators that are empowered to not only enforce net neutrality rules, but also to enforce rules that encourage build-out. So they see build-out to 100% connectivity as inextricably linked to net neutrality and open access. And so they're two sides of the same coin, and you have policies in place in many of those countries that encourage this kind of oversight that doesn't go too far and that doesn't regulate the content flowing over those networks, but allows regulators to encourage builders to build those networks in an open way to everybody.
And pardon my ignorance, Josh, but when you say build out, do you mean the infrastructure as it expands?
Yes, the infrastructure. So you have countries, for example, in Scandinavia, that where you have 100% connectivity, right? So when I say build out, I mean in this country building high-speed broadband for communities that don't have it. And there are a number of solutions. There are public solutions, there are private solutions, there are partnerships between the two. There's a lot of ways to do it, but you just need policies that empower those, you know, companies or local communities or cooperatives to build out those networks
so
that everybody has access and that the access is to an open internet.
Thank you so much. Let's try and squeeze in one more caller. Mitch from San Francisco Electronic Frontier Foundation, I think, is on the line with us. Hi, Mitch.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
Two comments. A lot of the debate about net neutrality has kind of dealt in hypotheticals, which is unfortunate because there's been a lot of really just sort of documented and pretty bad sort of examples of unequal treatment of data on the internet and of internet service providers playing favorites. The most well known was one of the worst was in 2007 when Comcast was caught interfering with their customers' use of certain communications protocols by simply interrupting them sort of silently and almost undetectably. There have been real examples of this, you know, sort of without needing to resort to sort of a what if, you know,
mm-hmm.
or, you know,
that it's not just a hypothetical.
That's right.
Got it. Yeah, and that was before the FCC rule existed. The 2007 example that you just cited, Mitch.
That is, although the FCC, try to fine Comcast for that, and that was a move that was also rejected by the court. But the other side of the scale is the solution, and it's possible that the solution might be worse than the problem in some circumstances. And I say that because the FCC really doesn't have a very good track record of sort of even-handed and useful regulation of communications media.
Let's piggyback on that. Go ahead and stay on the line, Mitch. We're running out of time here, but so Mitch gets to solutions and is a little skeptical about the FCC's ability to produce a workable solution. So what do each of you think are the solutions? You each have about 45 seconds. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think the FCC did a pretty good job of making sure that the basic telecommunications service, which for many years was the telephone service, was operated in a non-discriminatory way. So just based on that track record, I think it could easily be extended to the Internet. I'm not a fan of quite a bit of what the FCC does, and certainly its processes could be improved and so on, but, you know, it's what we've got. You know, we've got the government that we've got, and I think we need to find a way to make it do the right thing.
So reclassify broadband as telecom and regulate it as such. How about you, Josh?
Yeah, I agree. You know, the FCC, we don't do this work, and we don't talk about the FCC so much because we just love that agency, and we just can't stop talking about them. We do it because, as John said, that's the agency we've got. That's the way that the law is written, is that this is the agency that's supposed to be overseeing our communications networks. And so I think, interestingly enough, without these rules, you know, because they were thrown out by the court. The FCC now could take go down the wrong path and actually do, I think, Mitch, what you're suggesting, which is apply its authority in the wrong kinds of ways and get a little out of control about it. And that's one of the reasons why we want them to reclassify, because that would narrow their authority in a certain way. It would specify that their authority is over maintaining open networks and connectivity, and not about regulating the content that flows over those networks. And so that's one of the reasons why we want them to do this.
Michael, and you get the last word here. You've got about a minute. Solutions and call to action for listeners.
Right. Well, as my colleagues on the panel have pointed out, the FCC actually does have all the statutory authority it really needs to do the right thing. The history of the agency has been sort of a combination of doing the right thing and doing the wrong thing, and sometimes doing the right thing in the wrong way. So what we really need to be concerned about is not whether the FCC has the authority to do what it really should do, but to really look at who the incumbents are, who really is exercising pressure on the FCC and on Congress to do things that are self-interested and not in the public interest. And that really is where the rubber meets the road, I think. I think we need members of the public to really let the FCC and their members of Congress know that they think the open Internet and net neutrality is in their interest and in the public interest, and that the public really has to stand firm against pressure that the agency and Congress is going to get from the incumbent cable operators, from the combination of cable operators and content providers, which we already see too much of.
So you're saying
from
the public,
telecommunications.
The public really needs to be vocal about this so that the public interest is primary in this debate. That's Michael Hiltzik, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning business columnist of the L.A. Times. Josh Levy is the Internet Campaign Director with the Free Press. John Bergmeier is a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge. We'll put links to all of their information at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How far have we come with HIV/AIDS activism? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Sean Strub, author of Body Count, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival. What can we learn from the first wave of HIV/AIDS activism in the U.S.? What's the divide between the different communities who've been hit by this disease? And where do we go from here? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. We'll be right back.